Welcome to the Ice at Dartmouth podcast. This is Franklin Jacoby. Part of the reason many of us find science so compelling comes from the fact that scientific claims are supported by evidence. When we opt for more fuel-efficient transportation, decide to don masks, or avoid cigarette smoke, we are making decisions at least partly based on evidence. But evidence may not always be the most effective tool for connecting with non-scientists about scientifically informed behavior. We can see this across issues ranging from vaccination to climate change to wearing those masks. Rather than always appeal to cold hard evidence, perhaps more emotionally evocative modes of communication are better at reaching people. This is something that literature offers, and it's also something that Dr. Tasneem Hussain is passionate about. Tasneem is a physicist turned novelist who writes about physics, scientists, and our inexorable desire to push the limits of what we can know about the natural world. She is the author of Only the Longest Threads, and we are going to talk about the more personal and perhaps ultimately more persuasive side of doing scientific research and how she writes about it. I start our conversation asking about the emotional and subjective appeal scientists can feel sometimes for their theories.
For people who do hold on to those ideas so passionately, but who think that as scientists, we're so objective and so on. What do you think that they're not realizing that subjective passion they have for their ideas, or do you think that they just are trying to hold on to an ideal? What's going on? Do you think
that's actually something that I find very fascinating, and I've been thinking a fair bit about. And I think it has something to do also with the way science is perceived. I think we've bought into this image of science as scientists, and it's an image we perpetrate as well. So it's something that, you know, we try and have the public believe also, that it is this completely objective enterprise, and we are completely dispassionate, and we're all sort of, you know, absolutely clinical, and everything is this intellectual curiosity, and our emotions are not involved at all. And I think we say it enough that we kind of start buying into it, or at least we feel that that is the image we should portray. So, you know, I know that when like scientists sit among themselves and they talk about things, they're completely passionate about what they're doing. And, you know, and you can tell, like, even if they don't use those words, you can tell that there are people who, you know, who are massively invested in their theories. I mean, it's not the most rewarding in conventional terms, right? So these are perfectly smart people. I'm sure they could be earning more. You know, they don't have like anything tangible necessarily that they're building, even a lot of them, right? Like, especially theorists. So a lot of the payoff is this intellectual, I am figuring something out. Like, it's this, you know, this thrill of discovery, or like the passion that's really pushing you to figure something out. That's what kind of what's driving you. And that's a very strong emotional like pull, right? There's no tangible reason, in the sense that it's not necessarily paying your bills. It's not, you know, it's not necessarily doing all of those things. There's this, does that make any sense? Do you see what I'm saying?
It does. Yeah. I'm curious. So you worked on string theory quite a bit, which can be quite polarizing. Did you feel that pull with your work?
Yes. I mean, okay, let me try and finish what I was saying before this, and then I will get back to string theory also.
Okay, great, yeah.
But yeah, so what I was headed towards was this thing that I think we try and say that we're completely dispassionate, and, you know, we just want to find the truth. And to a certain extent, that's true. But it's not, we do want to find out what's at play, but I don't think it's completely dispassionate. And the reason I don't think that is because they're, you know, two or three or four perfectly smart people, why would they then be pulled to do different things, right? If everything is just so cut and dried and so completely unemotional, and if it's all just fact-based, then why isn't everyone pursuing the same theory? The reason I was talking about history was that it's a lot easier now to look back at issues that have been resolved, right? because we're not as emotionally invested anymore. Like, we just grew up in a world where this was accepted wisdom, and, you know, we've just kind of made our peace with it. But, like, why would people be so upset about, you know, whether the sun goes around the earth or the earth goes around the sun? Like, you're still living in the same world. It makes no tangible difference to your day or night or, you know, your family life or where you're getting your food or anything. Like, life will continue to be the same as it's always been. Why should it be such a huge issue? And the thing is, it's almost always goes back to something that it implies about the universe, and then the emotional charge or the emotional valence of that statement for you, right? So maybe you do not think, you know, you want everything to go around the earth. Why? Because, like, it's a way of making yourself feel, you know, important or at the center of things. And suddenly, if that's not what the earth is doing, well, then you've completely been displaced from your view, from your position in your view of how things were, right? So that's a lot more of an emotional reaction than, like, a logical, sensible reaction. And it's the same with so many other things, like with quantum mechanics, right? There's, I mean, Einstein and Bohr and had this, like, argument till the end. What does it matter? I mean, the atoms already know what to do, right? They've been doing what they're doing. They will continue doing what they're doing. But it's this, I cannot accept that the world works this way, right? That's an emotional statement. Because if the world is ruled by probability, well, then that's not how I think the world should be. Why not? You know, it's something that affects me. Like, I don't want my world to be ruled by chance. Like, I want to live in a predictable world. So it's almost always like it goes back to something like that. The same thing for string theory, because there are so many people who are like, well, this is so abstract. And, you know, what does it mean about reality to say that there are so many other dimensions that we can't see? So these things they're not just ideas that are mathematical. Like, they all mean something. They all have some kind of impact on your perception of the universe, like how you think about things. And that always has an emotional impact. One of the things that I was really intrigued about, and I ended up writing a little piece for Nautilus, the magazine, about this, was the multiverse. Because when I started reading about quantum mechanics and, you know, thinking it was at the time when it was still being, you know, uncovered and these discoveries were still new, I started thinking about, well, what is it that is similarly polarizing right now? And it had to be something that is not yet resolved, right? Something that the jury's still out on. And the multiverse is a great example of that. And I don't know how the jury will ever not be out on it, because that's a hard thing to prove. But incidentally, even for quantum mechanics, like, it's been 100 years. I don't know that we've reached consensus about what it means. It's just that people have gotten used to working with it and just sort of holding all of those, those assumptions and looking at the mathematics and just working with it. But every time someone sits down and does a deep dive into, wait, but what does this mean again? I don't know that we still have, you know, an answer. It's just that we kind of circumvent that, and everyone who's learning quantum mechanics in college does not necessarily sit down and think about what it means. It's just like, okay, well, this thing works, so we're going to use it. But those debates are still going on.
That's pretty amazing that there's a theory like quantum mechanics that could be around for so long, and yet
Like, at the heart of it, there are still these things about, you know, well, what does this really mean about reality? And I think there's a lot that we kind of, some of it is just necessary. We cannot, like, hold back for 100 years and just keep thinking about what something means and not use it. Like, quantum mechanics is one of the most experimentally tested theories. It works. So we know that the mathematics works. We know that, you know, there are certain predictions we can make about it, and those work. But to be able to work with something is different to having, like, a deep understanding of what it really means. And we know that it works. We still don't know exactly what it means. So there are still all of these paradoxes in quantum mechanics. I mean, you know, things like quantum entanglement, like, how do we think about that? like all of these little things that are still there, and there's still books being written about them, like literally every year, you know, what does quantum mechanics really mean? And so I think beyond a point when something has been proved to work, people kind of stop thinking about, you know, the implications on a daily basis, or at least the vast majority of people. Some of them, you know, some people are still invested in that, but the vast majority stop thinking. But when it's brand new, like if you're the person who came up with this discovery, it's impossible to not think about it, which is why I felt like, you know, to understand the real impact of these ideas, you have to kind of go back in time into the minds and like the times of someone who's seeing this for the first time. And so really, like there's nothing to absorb the shock. Like the whole thing is just sort of, you know, upon them in all its glory. And they're just coming to terms with all of it. But the multiverse, for instance, so that is one of the most polarizing concepts right now. You talk about people, there are some people who will hate the multiverse. There are other people who will say, you know, absolutely, I believe in the multiverse. And it is kind of a belief because there's no proof, you know. But either camp, like no one will make it out like it's just this random emotional preference. Everyone will back it up with reasons. So the people who, you know, who think the multiverse exists will give you like 100 good reasons why they think that. The people who don't think the multiverse exists will give you 100 good reasons why they don't think that. And the point is, if there was like nothing, if there was no emotional component to any of this, then it should be decided, right? It should be like a cut and dry thing, like who's right, who's wrong. But it's not really, because a lot of it has to do with the, you know, you're fighting for a worldview, basically. There are people who are thinking about the multiverse as, well, you know, this means anything can happen. Like there's infinite choice. And isn't that a great thing? And there are other people who are like, no, but this is a complete attack on like our sense of uniqueness. And that, you know, then we have like nothing means anything if everything's happening. So what's interesting is like I spoke to a number of scientists about this. And everyone kind of went back to, if you keep questioning them and you keep questioning them, it always goes back to, like, they'll show you how they think about the world. So all of these facts that they're lining up, these particular facts appeal to them because, you know, oh, look, it means that there's infinite choice. Or, you know, there's no way that can happen because then, like, nothing I say has any consequence, nothing I do, because if I'm being a really good person here, there's another universe where I'm being, you know, like Hitler the second. Like, what difference does it make? What difference do my choices make? So there are people who will respond to all of these things, but it always comes down to, this is not how I think the world should be. Or if you go one step beyond that, I think it's, this is not how I want the world to be. This is not how I want the world to work. I don't want the world to be probabilistic. I don't want there to be like a, you know, infinite copies of me parading around things. I don't know. I feel like there's almost always at the core of it, there's some emotional seed and a reaction to how we secretly want things to be.
How do you think something like quantum mechanics that was so controversial, and yet there's now quite a lot of consensus, I mean, maybe not on what it means, but on using it anyway. So does that mean that scientists came to accept the same sort of worldview? Or since we're not sure what exactly it means, they haven't accepted that worldview?
I think there's some things we know for sure. So in the beginning, there was this very strong shock just to even realize that nature was quantized, like at the smallest level, that there were, you know, that it was discontinuous, that there were jumps, that there were like the smallest unit of something. So that came as a huge shock. That was not something that was expected. And yes, that is something that people have, you know, have absorbed into their worldview, and they've learned to work with it. So that's the kind of thing that you try and you experiment and you probe and you run these calculations. And every time you you build a model using that assumption, that model bears fruit, right? There's, you're able to predict what you want to predict. So yeah, so there are things like that that you completely just, you think, okay, well, that was unexpected. Like, I wouldn't have necessarily seen that coming. But yes, that is clearly the way things are. But there are other things that I think are still being thought about, you know, things about like probability. So there's this question about, is it is quantum mechanics probabilistic because that's just how we are formulating the theory right now? Like, is there a better way to write down that, you know, a theory of these like discrete little quanta, but not have it run by probability? Like, is there just another way of framing it? Or is that, is it just because nature is fundamentally probabilistic, right? So those kinds of things people still have different opinions about. And there I'd say maybe, you know, the jury is still out. Like, the theory we have is doing a really, really, really good job. So it's very hard to figure out where we could go wrong with it. But we also know, so there's for string theory, it's basically one of the main attractions of string theory is that we've had, you know, these two major theories of physics in the past century. There was quantum mechanics and there was the theory of relativity, special and general relativity. And Einstein had a hand in both. And so one completely revolutionized the way we think of gravity, and the other completely revolutionized the way we think of, you know, of atoms and like the structure of the fundamental structure of matter and the fact that it's granular and not, you know, not the smooth thing. But both of those theories, so far, every prediction they've made is borne out. I mean, quantum mechanics is the most tested theory, you know, all of this entire electronics revolution, like everything, so much of what we're doing right now depends on quantum mechanics. And all of those tests have been, you know, it's met all of those tests. On the other hand, so has general relativity. Like, you know, things about the black hole, gravitational waves, like all of these predictions of general relativity, which seemed completely out there. And, you know, who knows if we'll ever even be able to see something like this, this fade. But we were, and we know that those things work. The problem, though, is that at the heart, they're both, they're inconsistent with each other. And so that was kind of the pull of string theory, is to find a quantum theory of gravity. It's because so far, gravity is still what they call like a classical theory, in the sense that it does not account for this, this quantum nature of matter. And we know that if you have two completely different theories, and the reason it works for the most part is that for the most part, they work in these mutually exclusive domains. So quantum mechanics is the theory of things that are very, very small. Like, that's where it really comes into play. And general relativity is a theory of how mass deforms space. And that really comes into play when you're talking of huge masses, right? So you're talking of things that are very, very heavy. And typically, you don't have things that are very, very tiny and also massively heavy. So for the most part, you're able to say, okay, you know, this is a quantum mechanics problem, this is a general relativity problem, and I will just use whichever theory is most suited to this problem. But there are some things that are tiny and massively heavy. So for instance, the Big Bang, you know, what do you do about the Big Bang? Like, it was next to no space and all of the energy of the universe, like, you know, there's this huge massive explosion. So there are things like that. There are things, you know, the singularities in within black holes, very extreme conditions, not things that we come across every day, which is why these theories have been able to kind of go their separate ways for the most part. But we know that there are places in the universe where they would collide. And other than that, I think it's just the intellectual, like, you know, thorn in our side of knowing that one theory is formulated in one way, the other is formulated in the other way. They cannot be stitched together. Like, they're saying completely different things about the nature of reality. One is saying it's continuous, the other one is saying it's not. Like, there has to be some bigger paradigm here. There has to be some way of kind of subsuming the two and putting them together into like a coherent picture, instead of always just keeping them, you know, at the other ends of the room, like they're always fighting, just keep them to one side. So there are things that, you know, we learn to accept, and then there are other things that we just don't know the answers to yet.
And do you think there are some things, I suppose, that are just easier for us to learn to accept, and some of them are just too much of an affront?
Yeah, I think some things are also just, they're so in your face. Like, it's obvious, like, people did not necessarily want to accept that nature was this way. But if, you know, if you keep seeing it, right, if you keep, if every experiment reveals the same thing and you keep on and on and on coming up against the same thing, you learn to accept it. You know, that's, again, that's part of the contract you make as a scientist, is that, you know, you will accept those things and move on. Like, you can't just rail against, well, why is it this way? Whether or not you like it, you learn to accept it and move on. And I've forgotten who said this now, but there was this really interesting quote about someone who said that the next generation always finds it easier. So the people who come up, you know, against these like paradigm shifts always find it hard to incorporate. But the next generation kind of grows up with these assumptions. You know, these things are just known. So for them, it's not as much of a shift in their worldview. And so in a couple of generations, it just kind of becomes accepted, you know, knowledge, and that's just the world we live in now. But there are some things, I think, which remain unresolved. And those are the ones that keep kind of nagging at you. Because they're kind of still alive, you know, you haven't been able to put them to rest. Like, if something is resolved, whether or not it's fair, you just, you know, you learn to live with it. But if it's unresolved and it's still kind of rankling, it's harder to put it aside, I think.
For some of these sorts of issues, I guess looking back on them historically, then it sounds like it's not just a case of tallying up the evidence. It's a case of trying to shift someone's worldview, I suppose, which is perhaps a very difficult thing to do.
I think actually, so that's something that I'm increasingly interested in for a whole bunch of reasons. I think one of the problems that we have right now in the world has a similar root. I mean, there's so many people who will, you know, quote unquote, not believe in science. Like, there's almost this antagonistic relationship between a branch of the public and scientists.
Yes, yes.
And that's a huge issue, right? It's no longer, oh, I don't believe quantum mechanics is like this or whatever. It's like, it has tangible consequences, things like climate change, you know, they're like anti-vaxxers, for instance. Like, there are all of these things, even right now, like with the pandemic, initially there was this whole thing of, you know, well, I don't want to wear a mask. It's like, you don't get to tell me what to do. You know, it's my right, like, you know, all of those things. Like, this is an affront to my rights and my beliefs, and I don't believe in it, right? Or I don't believe in the science. And so I think more and more, like, science runs so much of our world right now that we're coming up against this more and more. And there's, you know, there's so much of an effort, like so many scientists are doing so much outreach to try and convince people and tell them what the facts are and, you know, lay the facts out. Like, there are these amazing infographics. They're like beautiful documentaries. There's the most incredibly clear, concise, compelling explanation of fact, right, that people are putting across. It's still always not working. And why is that? And to me, I feel that it's because what we need to shift is we need to dig into what we're saying, what these facts, what emotional value are people ascribing to them? And that's kind of what we need to change. So I feel like, you know, of course we need to tell people facts. Like, of course, facts are a huge part of science, and I'm not trying to minimize that. I'm just saying that that can't be all of it. Like, it's not just that, oh, people don't understand this because they don't have the requisite facts. It's also, there needs to be some kind of an emotional connection. Like, where there's a place where this relationship is ruptured. Like for some reason, people don't believe scientists because, you know, there's some sort of a emotional bond that needs to be established. And we need to understand why people are rebelling against these things and kind of change the way they feel about it before we can change the way they will think about it. And there's so much work that's being done even about things like that. So for instance, you know, anti-vaxxers, like why do people, and again, those things are getting more and more complicated. Like I was telling you about my son who's in preschool right now. We just had this newsletter, I guess, that came around that said that in Massachusetts now, the law is that every child who was, you know, attending a preschool for however long they're open will have to have a flu shot on record, right? So it's no longer that it's just this do whatever you want and we're assuming that you're going to do the right thing. It's now like it's a public safety issue. Like you have to have that thing done. And so when you're in situations like this, things just become more and more polarized because the people who, you know, absolutely refuse to do that, then are going to, it's not going to be as invisible as it was, say, 5 years ago, right? Like people didn't go around asking, did you get your kid a flu shot this year? Now it's going to be the kind of thing that's really going to matter. It's going to polarize people. It's going to be an issue. And the question is, like, instead of saying, you know, well, someone is completely ridiculous, like, why would they choose to make such a stupid decision and so on and so forth? If you try and understand what's at the heart of it, like, if you're assuming that most people, like, that these are not abusive parents and they actually want the best for their child, like, why would they make that choice? Why would they decide not to vaccinate their child? What is it that is really terrifying them? Right. So if you go to the heart of that, and again, that's an emotional reaction. That's not a logical reaction. It's this very instinctive, I want to protect my child. So most of these people, you know, have heard something about how like the drug will, you know, if you vaccinate the child, it's going to, I don't know, cause autism or whatever, like all of these things that were said about these vaccines. Right. And if you go and you address those things, those sort of emotional reactions, and you talk about the fact that, yes, you know, I completely understand it. How terrifying would it be if you thought that you had done something that had harmed your child? But, you know, like, look at the odds of that and look at the odds of this and look at, you know, what would happen in that case and look at what's happening if you choose not to do it. So if it's more of a, if you're engaging more on an emotional level instead of just like throwing facts at people and saying, well, you're, you know, if you don't understand all of this data that I'm throwing at you, you're just being stupid. I think that just makes people sort of, you know, more entrenched, let's just say, like more rebellious, more entrenched. Or for climate change, right? Maybe it's just too huge and too scary and just, you know, too like mind-numbing to contemplate. Maybe it's just something that people do not want to come to terms with. But if you can try and like, you know, meet them in smaller, like try and explain what's happening at like a smaller level. And also there are all these things about how, like when you talk about global issues and things that are so huge and have such a large scope, our minds have a really hard time accepting that.
It's hard to even think about issues on that scale.
It is. I was doing the science writing workshop once and I came across this, I was trying to sort of make an argument for why it's better to write in terms of specifics. And I did this little experiment and I kind of thought I knew how it would go, but it still shocked me. There was this thing about how, you know, so many, do you remember the picture of this little Syrian child? I think this was about 4 years ago, who was washed up on a shore when his family was trying to escape.
In the Mediterranean.
Yes, yes. Do you remember that? Okay. Everyone who has seen that picture remembers that child. And that one photograph had the kind of emotional impact that it never did when you see a headline that says, you know, thousands of people trying to escape, right? So that's exactly what I did. Like and I even didn't have to show the photograph. I just asked people, I was like, do you remember? And everyone's like, oh, yes, I remember. You show that one picture and then you show the headline. The headline just does not have that same impact. I think it's just too much. Like it's too much for our minds to take in. We we cannot picture like thousands of children, but that one child, like that one child has got everyone in the heart, because you can see your own child, your own like nephew, grandson, you know, grand or whatever, like some child you know and love, you can see in that one picture. In the thousands, that thing just gets lost. Like it's just too big to contemplate. I think that's the problem with a lot of things in science when we try and talk about generalities. So the thing with science is that that's the strength, right? Is that we're able to talk of laws and generalities and like these big, large, you know, these equations that work in so many conditions. So you're subsuming a lot of knowledge and you're containing it in a tiny equation. So that is the power of science. That whole generality is the power of science. But when you're trying for emotional impact and you're trying for emotional connection, you have to unpack it and you have to talk about the particulars. Otherwise, you're not really connecting with people anymore. So for me, it's like, you know, those equations and all, they're massively efficient containers of knowledge. Like if we needed a different equation for every, you know, every system, or if we needed to understand like, you know, every human being's physiology separately, that would really not be a very efficient way of working. So the whole point of medicine is that you have this model of the human body, like you understand how certain things work and how certain systems work. But when you're like, if you're sick and you're in the hospital and the doctor is completely, you know, disconnected and rash, like people hate that. You know, you want to know that like this doctor is super competent. He or she knows what they're doing. They're going to do an amazing job at the surgery. But this will care for you. Like this will connect as an individual human being. You still have some meaning. And I think it's the same thing for all of this. So you kind of have this balance where where like the power of science comes from that generality. And you have to hold on to that and you have to use that. But when you're talking to people, you still have to be like, yes, I see you. Like you are not one of millions. It has to be more specific than that. I also think there's a very interesting analogy in special relativity. So there are equations that you have that are true. It's said, you know, in all frames of reference is how you say it, right? There are things that are invariant. So for instance, E equals MC squared is one of those things, always true. However you do it, wherever you do it, always true. But the interesting thing is, in order to make a measurement, so there are certain things you can say that are always true. They will be true here on the moon, you know, wherever you choose to take yourself in the universe. We think they will always be true. But if you restrict yourself to those invariants and you restrict yourself to things that you can say that are always true, you won't be saying a whole lot. There's just very little that you can say. If you want to make any kind of measurement, if you want to say anything specific, you have to choose what we call a frame of reference. You have to kind of, you know, choose your origin. You have to choose your coordinates. You have to say, am I moving? Am I still? You have to choose a particular set. And that's how you can talk about, you know, that's how you sort of populate a richer world. That's how you can make more statements. That's how you can say more interesting things. It's like, you know, someone just wants to talk in like universal truths, just like aphorisms or whatever, just things that are, you know, always true. And you're just going to speak just like that. It's not going to make for a very interesting conversation. Like you have to be able to, you know, come down to specifics. And that's what I think the power of literature is, right? Is that we read about these very specific people in a very specific set of circumstances, some of which we, you know, have no external resemblance to our lives at all. And yet if it had no relevance at all, we wouldn't be interested, we wouldn't be reading it, right? So you realize that even though it's very specific and those specifics are very different to the specifics of your situation, there's still something that is sort of overarching that you can absorb from it. And so I don't know that necessarily makes any sense. What I'm trying to say is that in some sense, science is, you know, it uses all of these universal statements, and you kind of have to unpack them to get to the particulars. So it, you know, you sort of take all of this knowledge and you compress it into these equations, which are very efficient containers. And then you can use that equation in any situation that you find yourself in, right? You just have to say what the situation is, and then you can use that equation and you can extract whatever information you need for your specific circumstance. That's what a theory would ideally enable you to do. Literature kind of works the other way, in that you look at something that is very specific. It seems like, you know, you're talking about this one protagonist in this one situation, and yet you're able to go into, like, hone into that one very specific thing and yet take out something universal. So it's kind of, you know, are you like zooming in? Are you zooming out? Like, how are you containing that information? And to me, like, that's always just been a really interesting tension between the two. And that's kind of like why I like talking this. It's really fascinating how you can, you need both, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at. You need both. You need to be able to have universal statements, and you need to be able to go in there and unpack the particulars. It's almost like, you know, if you have like a graph and you have a curve, and the equation is that whole curve, and then you can zoom in on any point and say, okay, well, this is this point right here. And in a funny way, it's like, you know, literature is completely different. It's that one point, and you can zoom out and create the curve that you need to create. So it's kind of like, you know, going in and out, back and forth. But again, I think you need both. I think you, if literature restricts itself to something completely specific that is only relevant to that one person, nobody else will ever want to read it. And if science insists on talking about just generalities, then it doesn't seem to have any relevance to, you know, to your specific life. So I do think some of the problems that we're having right now, and that, you know, that we've had, I guess, always, but now they're more immediate and in the forefront, just because science is running more of our lives right now. A lot of them have to do with being able to connect with people emotionally and show them the that it's not just this, you know, abstract, unfeeling thing out in the sky, like that there is this emotional connection, and that science is not this like cold, rigid thing. It's something that, you know, that matters in your life, and figure out ways of making it matter to people, and figure out ways of, you know, establishing those emotional connections and having people sort of see themselves reflected in it. I think there's a lot of relationship building. It's almost like, you know, we need therapy, kind of. It's like relationship therapy. Figure out how to repair this sort of this rupture that we have somehow created.
And so we perhaps need a literature that is more about science, as well as scientists, to rethink this objective face that we sometimes want to project?
I think so. And so to me, not that like I would claim to have a solution, but this is just something I've been thinking about increasingly for the past, you know, 5-10 years now. And I think what makes sense to me, at least as a first step, is for scientists to be more open about the process of science. It's almost like, you know how there's this concept of the unreliable narrator in a piece of literature? So someone says something, and then you know, the narrator says something, and it's not necessarily true, and then you end up just not believing them. I think to a certain extent, we've kind of done that to ourselves as scientists, because there's some people don't necessarily understand the process, right? People who are on the outside don't necessarily understand the process. And so when you make a statement, and then 2 years later, you qualify that statement, or you kind of retract part of that statement, it's seen as you're contradicting yourself, or that you're being unreliable, or that you're untrustworthy. Whereas if someone understood the process that you're going through, And they understand that, you know, science is not this revealed thing. Like, it's something that we're constructing based on the evidence we have right now. And if you understand how that works, and you understand that, look, based on these, you know, this piece of information, this is the best I can say for now. But, oh, look, I have two more pieces of information. So the example I will always give is, you know, if you have like a set of dots, you know, like in those join the dot kind of things, you can connect those dots to make one picture or two or three or whatever. But if you add like three more dots, suddenly you can make pictures that you just couldn't make before, because now all of these other connections are also possible. It's not that you've changed what happened before, right? It's not like you've interfered with any of the dots that were on that page before, but you've added three new dots. Like, you just discovered, you know, these three new facts, and suddenly you can reconnect everything that you had before. That happens so much in fiction. Like, there'll be people who will, and in real life, I think that's why we can kind of relate to that model. Never called me back. Oh, it must be, they hate me. It must be because of something, you know, just whatever. Like, there'll be this thing, there'll be this theory in my head. They never liked me. Maybe I messed up that day. Maybe I shouldn't have said this. Maybe I shouldn't have done that. And then I have like a new piece of information. You know, say I found out that something really awful happened there in their home and they were busy and that's why they couldn't call me. Suddenly it changes my whole impression of that person. Like, I will completely revise, you know, from the, they were always hateful, they always hated me, like this never, this friendship was never meant to, oh my, you know, how could I say that? And how? So we do that all the time in our daily interactions with people. We see people do that in fiction all the time, right? Where it's a lot easier because it's kind of separated from us. Like, someone will discover a new fact and suddenly it'll change everything. And I think to realize that the same kind of process is at work in science. So it's not that scientists are randomly changing their minds. It's not like, you know, 1 year everyone thinks eggs are good for you and the next year everyone's like, don't ever have eggs again. It's, you know, it's not that they're being like whimsical, but if you look at it completely from the outside, it's like people in their ivory towers who are just throwing out these decrees that they, you know, claim are objective and scientific and 100% fact. If you take it that way, it's very easy to grow to distrust them. But if you understand what they're doing and you understand the complexity of it and how much work they're putting into it and how it's this perturbative thing, right? You know, we're slowly building up towards a better model. If you understand that, then it's a lot easier to trust what people are saying, because this is a process we all use in our everyday lives. But in order to do that, I think we need to be more open about the process of science. Right? We need to kind of go behind the scenes and show what it is. I think we also need to, especially for the more abstract sciences, I think we also need to open up a little bit about how we think about these things and why they matter to us. So, you know, it's not magic. Like, the whole, it's not like this magic trick that we're doing that we need to conceal all of our secrets and, you know, we just want it to be a perfect illusion. Because that's just a trick. If it's something that we want people to be like emotionally invested in, we kind of need to show them, you know, how we're building up to it, who the people are who are invested in these things. And that's learning a lot more. Like, if you really, you notice, like in a lot of science stories, you know, they'll talk about the scientists. They'll talk about the home lives of the scientists. They'll sort of show you the scientist is a human being with, you know, these hopes and dreams and desires and setbacks and issues. And that kind of has you rooting for them in a different way, because suddenly you're kind of emotionally connecting to them, right? So even if you don't understand exactly what they're doing, you can see the human being behind all of this, and it, you know, it pulls you in a different way. So I think that's one thing we need to do, is kind of change that, that clinical, surgical, this is too hard, you know, those danger keep out kind of things. We need to change that. Also a cultural thing. I think people want to be behind the scenes of everything. There was this very, very successful exhibition that went all around the world. It was called Collider, and it was a recreation of CERN and of the Large Hadron Collider, basically. And one of the major pulls of that exhibition was, like, you know, almost like a groundbreaking thing, and sold out everywhere, and people were going crazy about it. And one of the things was that people got to walk in. So they've done a really good job. They've like taken huge photographs and, you know, made recreated spaces to look like the halls in the Large Hadron Collider. So it looked like you were walking through the tunnel. And it looked like, you know, you could kind of walk through the experiment. And just that thrill of something that people think is completely off, off limits, right? It's just, you're barred from it. Like, people want to know what's going on behind the scenes. Like, people want to walk in those shoes. People want to, you know, try out those things. And once you can walk in those shoes, suddenly it has a different meaning for you. So I think this whole thing of like shutting people out kind of needs to stop. On the other hand, that's kind of why I write in the way that I do. That's how my first book came about. It's kind of how my second book is coming about very slowly. Fiction, I think, is, you know, does that better than even virtual reality can, right? Because it doesn't just show you what someone else is seeing. It kind of lets you into their thoughts and their emotions. And you can literally try it on for size. Like, you can try on what it's like to be someone else. I studied theoretical physics, and my whole life people were saying, you know, well, what do you do? And I never had anything that I had built to show them. Like, it was always calculations, you know, things on paper. Like, is this what you do all day? Like, there's nothing tangible. There's nothing concrete. Why do you do it? And I always felt like in order to show someone the pull that it has for me and what it does for me, I would literally have to let them inside my head. And I thought, you know, fiction is the only way I know how to do that, is to put someone in the mind of a scientist, like really have them see what it is that's going on in my head. Like, how am I learning to make sense of the world? These things that I'm studying, you know, how does that affect my worldview? How does it affect my emotions? Like, what is it doing to me? How is it changing me? And I think once you can see those things, you learn to relate to scientists in a completely different way. So to answer your question, I think it needs to be twofold. I think scientists need to kind of engage more, you know, and show the process a little bit more. But I think also there needs to be more fiction about scientists, about the process of science, about what it's like to engage with science. So that, I mean, the idea is that slowly science should become a part of culture. Like, it shouldn't be this thing apart. It shouldn't be this thing that either you like or you don't. I mean, in an ideal world, I would like it to be where, you know how if you go to like a dinner or something, very few people will claim to not have read some of the classics that everyone, that are kind of part of the canon and everyone thinks you should have read. Like, if someone mentions, you know, a book like that, or someone mentions an artist like that, even if you don't really know them, it's like, yeah, you know, kind of, you want to go out and admit, because it's supposed to be one of the things that you're supposed to do as, you know, as part of an all-rounded education. I think ideally science should be one of those things. You know, I want to live in a world where it's as normal and natural to know a little bit about quantum mechanics and relativity as it is to know, you know, well, who was Picasso, or what did, you know, what are the great works of Leonardo da Vinci, or have you been to, you know, have you ever heard anything by Mozart? Like, it doesn't mean that you need to be a skilled practitioner. It doesn't mean that you need to be able to go and replicate any of those things. It's just that these are some of the great accomplishments of history, right? These are some of the things that are part of all of our intellectual legacy. And it really makes our perspective on the world so rich. Like, what does art do for us, right? It just makes your life so much richer, you know, to know these things, to have these things at your disposal. Like, and I think science can do the same thing. It can just make your life so much richer. It's not about tangible benefits. It's not about technology. It's not about, you know, it's not about all of those things necessarily. It's about giving you new paradigms, new ways of thinking about things, and kind of stretching your mind. And I think in order for science to become, and that just does change your relationship with it, right? If it's not just something that you're seeing in a textbook, like if you've read this book about a scientist who just was massively in love with their ideas and what they were doing, but that's not the whole story. Like, it's just incidental to things. You absorb it in a different way. Like, I was reading the other day that there's so many people who know, people who read like crime and thrillers and things, they know the most amazing facts about, like, you know, how to rob a bank. Like, there are all of these facts that you pick up, or people who watch, like, you know, things like ER and like all of these medical shows, they, in the process, they learn so much about disease. Whether we have an issue with learning facts or that, it's just that when it's presented in a way that's organic and natural and, you know, and normal, like, our minds are sponges. That's how we're built to learn things. It's only when they're sort of systematic and cut and dry that we start rebelling against it, right? But if there's a reason to understand it, and if it's just like part of what you need in order to survive right now, I mean, of course you're going to learn it. So I think we kind of need to frame science in that way, and that it's not this, you know, let me force feed you. It's just like, it's part of this greater whole, and you just, you absorb it kind of just by osmosis, you know, it just kind of sinks into you. And then you start relating to it differently. And I think that's kind of the shift that we need. Like, there is an, there's an emotional tug also. It's not just this this completely objective, clinical, you know, removed kind of thing. There's a subjectivity to it also.
Thank you very much, Tasneem, for talking about this. It's such an important topic, especially now. And I could talk about it all day with you, but I'm afraid practicality gets in the way.
No, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. I'm grateful to everyone at ICE at Dartmouth and to Tasneem Hussain for making this episode possible. We listen to The Wonder of Science by Lexan Music. Stay tuned for more episodes or check ice.dartmouth.edu. Thank you.